When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
This show is supported by its patrons at patreon.com/thefelixclub. If you enjoy the show, remember you can support it too. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 104. We're in February 2018, and today we talk about the experiences of Nicholas in the French Navy. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we cover the news from the world. From the past month or so, we get people from different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds to tell us how they saw the important news from the past month, as I said. And every once in a while, usually every month actually, we do a special episode where we just have one guest and we focus on their experiences. They might be from a different country, from a different background, from a different even religion or political affiliation, or just something different entirely. And today is one of those days. My name is Patrick Beja. I'm very happy to be emerging from the land of diapers to be able to do the show again. Although, I guess for the Phileas Club, I interrupted some of my shows, but the Phileas Club basically didn't get interrupted, so I'm very proud of that. And so as I was saying, we have a really cool guest today. His name is Nicolas Lebègue. He is French, and I'm first gonna say hi. How's it going, Nicolas?
Hey, hi everybody. Thank you, Patrick, for the invite, and I'm fine.
Excellent. Absolutely fine. Let's not spoil the suspense. Actually, people have read the title of the episode. The reason I asked you to be on the show, and I'm very glad you agreed to be on the show, is you are basically, you were part of the French military, of the French Navy specifically, for about 7 years. Now you live in Estonia, and maybe at some point we should do a special on Estonia as well, because it's a really interesting country. But you're basically a soldier. Or you were a soldier. I don't know if you can ever stop being a soldier.
That can be a topic. How do we switch off the modes or not? Or if, do we even stop, actually, to be?
Yeah.
But that's an open question, yeah.
You were in the Navy specifically for about 7 years. We're going to talk about all of this, explore it, try to get a glimpse into the daily life of a French military personnel. And first of all, let's start with a little bit of an introduction. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe right now, and then let's go back in time to explore how you got into that path?
No problem. So, yeah, I'm 32. I'm living in Estonia, as you said, married with an Estonian woman, having a beautiful child as well. Living here since 4.5 years now in Tallinn. I'm working in, let's say, IT consultancy, so to speak. And yes, before I served the Navy for about 7 years, ended up there. Well, it was kind of written because
I'm. Are you one of those military families?
Yeah, yeah. My dad was part of the Navy as well. My granddad, well, both granddad actually served during the Second World War. So, well, it was written somewhere. So I got educated also some sort in the Navy environment.
So was so, it, yeah. You know, did you actually expect you would make at least a little spin in the military, or did it happen at some point? I don't know how old you were when you joined, but did it happen unexpectedly almost?
Well, I joined, I was 21. Well, it's kind of weird because coming from a military, let's say, family, so to speak, I was raised, let's say, in this environment, meaning that dad came to pick me at work, at school, after work with the, you know, the official suit and everything, you know, the uniform. When he was on duty on weekend, I went with him, you know, because he was taking care of fighting planes. So we moved every 3 years, with different assignments. So it was kind of, let's say, I never say to myself, I will join the Navy, but at the same time, I didn't see anything else to do, you know? So yeah, I got my, what we call in France, baccalauréat. So basically the high school education. And then I was like, all right, you know, it's time now to go and see what's there.
But you said you joined at, around 21. Was there a moment of hesitate? Because I guess you got the back around 18, 19.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, basically what happened is that I was thinking about what to do because the Navy is a bit different compared if we take with the Army, for example. Army, you join as a soldier first, and then things happen that you get specialized and et cetera. In the Navy, it's the opposite. They first hire specialized people, and they look a lot at your graduations and et cetera. And also, what, let's say, level of education you will get will give you a path. So either you join like as a soldier, so to speak, either you join as a petty officer or as an officer. And for different schools and different, let's say, road or path you have to take in the Navy, they will require you to have some sort of level of education. So they are looking first at people who are specialized, and then they will train you to be part of the Navy, but you will also do a specialization school. So the two, let's say, years of differences were more about me trying to figure out if I can get anything out of university or something. It failed miserably.
Okay. But it was always with the idea that you would probably join. Like, even if you tried at university, you thought, yeah, I'm going to go in the Navy. Before we go into the career itself, I do want to ask, being from a military family, because I think a lot of our listeners are, you know, American. And there is a very different image of military personnel, I think, in the US than in France. Certainly, it's not like the French dislike the military, but in the US, there is a level of reverence. And, you know, it's always, anytime you say, you know, oh, I'm a soldier, I did a tour in whatever, Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, it's like, immediately you have a kind of weight, the weight of the service of the service person. And then it's like, oh, thank you for your service, and you become very deferential, and well, in most cases, in the good cases, I would guess. In France, I don't think we are it's not like we dislike the military, but it's more like, ah, yeah, okay, a little bit, maybe a little bit of suspicion, even, like, are you some kind of somewhat how can you
spy,
put it? Maybe not a spy, but maybe, you know, it's the authority of the government. Like, it's almost in the US, you would expect that the military arm of the government, given the suspicion the population tends to have of the government itself, the military arm would be regarded as even more suspect, but it's not the case. In France, it's a tiny little bit like, oh, okay, you're here to, you know, make war and repress uprisings and stuff like that, right? So I wonder how it was.
Basically, you do a very good point right now, because, of course, today I'm talking, and I'm not talking in the name of the army or the Minister of Defense. It's just a personal experience. it's very important. And also the perception of the army is a very personal thing. And even I would say, depending on what corp you will represent, you will be seen differently. So if we compare with the US, and it's also linked to the communication and the way the army and the Ministry of Defense communicates about the army in general. If we take the USA, I got the chance to work with American soldiers, and there is some sort of natural respect toward the civilian people and the citizens, because there is this big patriotic thing in America, and they are really representing the flag, and it means something very strong in America. They really join to serve at the very, let's say, first level of some sort of gut feeling, you know, they serve their country. Yeah. In France, we are a bit different. First, of course, the army in general and the Ministry of Defense doesn't communicate the same way to the public. We have even a name for that in French, La Grande Muette, which means basically the one who says nothing.
Yeah, the big mute. It's the army is the one that's not supposed to say anything, to express its opinions, mostly political. But yeah, it's yeah,
exactly. So the perception of being a military person is, I don't know, maybe we could ask to somebody from army, but from the Navy side, it has been every time positive, because people are not used to see seamen in streets. We see soldiers in streets, and especially with the sad news that are happening in the world, we see policemen, we see everything. But the seamen, you never see them. You see them at the 14th of July walking, and you know, you don't really know. Even the mission of the Navy are not known most of the time. People have no clue what they are doing.
You mentioned the 14th of July. The one other difference. It's interesting because in France, we have this big military parade on the Bastille Day, which is the 14th of July. It's kind of a staple of the year, and it's an event, a political media event. It's funny because in the US, there's a big debate happening now on the reasons of the parade, which it's a different story. But in France, even though we don't have the same level of respect, I think most people would agree the big military parade of the 14th of July is kind of it's expensive, but it's kind of a tradition, and no one looks at it and says, you know, that's a huge waste. Well, I'm sure some people do, but most people don't say it's a huge waste of money, or like it's pretentious or it's dictatorial. We don't see it like that at all. So there is still some level of, you know, respect there as well. It's like, some pride, I would say, in those moments, very localized.
Yes. And I got the chance to walk, and to be part of the parade, once. And I'm absolutely grateful for that. And to be very honest, I didn't feel any bad things. When you're walking on the Champs-Élysées, basically, with your uniform representing either your school or a squad or a unit or whatever, and you have people cheering at you, you're feeling useful. Because in the end of the day, that's what we do. Of course, there is questions. There will be every time question about how to use army, even the usefulness of army in general. There is questions to that. And even the Ministry of Defense himself asks, let's say, this question, because the format of army is changing a lot over the time. There is no big war like it used to be before. It's very different. The world is different. But whatever the people think and whatever the people say, when you're walking on this big parade, you feel like people support you. You feel like the whole nation is behind you, and supporting what you defend or what you try to say as a message. And that is fantastic, to be honest.
So I wonder how the feeling was among the people you were walking with. I guess it was pride for everyone. And okay.
It was pride, and it was also the end of something, because what we don't see as well is that this parade is month and month and month and month of training. It's 8 hours walking a day, training, walking, because it has to be perfect. And, you know, even if it's perfect, it's not perfect enough. You know, it's never perfect enough in army. So, but still it was worth every step made. This training, I did it in Brest. So basically Brittany, in spring, it was horrible. It was raining all day. We were wet. We were like, yeah, it was horrible, the training part. But when it was our time to start to walk, it was fantastic. It was about maybe 5 minutes of walking in total, but felt like hours. And it was in a good way. It was very great. So yeah, coming back to the topic, I think the feeling in general, I never had a negative feedback, never ever, in a train or, because it happens sometimes, especially when you're at school, military school, they force you to, you have to wear the uniform when you go to vacation. So until you're home, you have to wear your uniform. There is some sort of, let's say, free marketing out there. But even in the train with civilians and people are asking you, and they are more curious, actually, if you look at it that way. Like, oh, what's this uniform? Oh, it's the Navy. All right. So outside of, let's say, the Navy cities like Brest, Toulon, what else, Lorient, all these cities that are known to see seamen every day because, well, the cities are built around the military activity. But outside of these cities, people are more curious than anything else and usually pretty supportive.
Mm. Okay, well, that's actually good to hear because I would have thought that you would have had like an incident or something that would have happened. But it's true. When I think about it, the French don't really... there isn't a deep, you know, dislike or disrespect of the military, or even, I mean, it depends where you go. Maybe the police is a little bit different, but the military, there's the weight of the function is ingrained in the population, I think. So, okay, let's get back to the actual career. So you start your training, you go through a bunch of stuff. Then you get posted on, you were saying it's a 90 people vessel, a warship?
Yeah, a warship, yeah.
How does that even work? Like, I'm guessing it's not very large. Like, could you describe to us the daily routine of a French Navy? Oh, I didn't ask actually, what post did you occupy when you got posted?
Well, actually, I did. I was mostly administrative. So, but with a little twist, because in Navy there is every time a twist, especially on warship. So basically, when you get assigned to a warship, you have your position, so to speak. So I was basically in human resources, taking care of people, but at the same time, you have a lot of side duties. So side duties mean you need to participate to the life of the boat because the boat never stops. It's 24 hours. So there is two kind of life. There is the life when you are at the port, so basically working hours, and then you have the life on the sea, which is a full different thing. So yeah,
I know you also saw combat at some point, but let's talk about first maybe the life on the ship itself.
Okay.
Describe to us a typical day. First, I guess, at when you're at port, which is going to be, I think by what you're saying, going to be kind of boring, just regular business hours. And then at sea, just a regular day from wake up to sleep.
So it's very simple because actually there is a person on the boat that is responsible for organizing the day and the task on board. So you will basically arrive before 8, because at 8 is the ceremony of color, basically the flag ceremony. So basically the whole crew is on the back of the boat, and we have the ceremony where we raise the flag, the French flag. After that, the day starts, so from 8, basically. The day starts if you are not on duty, because that's also another twist. If you're not on duty, it means that you will just have a normal day. So basically from 8 to about 4 or 5, depending on what you have to do, very normal day. So for me, it was just going to the office, taking care of the file of the people,
Do you mean? Yeah. What do you mean if you're not on duty?
So that's the second thing.
Oh,
the
boat, okay, sorry.
As I said, it's a bit weird and hard to explain, because being on duty, because the boat never stops, even at port, on the port, because... There it's a warship. There is weapons on board. You still need to have, even if you are in a military port that is closed and guarded, you still need to have people constantly on the boat. The boat is never alone. There's every time from 8 to 12 people on board, even at night. And even at the, let's say, entry of the boat, there will be people guarding the gate constantly, 365 days, 24/7.
Right. So on duty, you mean on guard duty, making sure no one, you know, Captain America doesn't jump. Jump on the boat. And I was referencing the Winter Soldier where he's on the boat. And,
okay. It's exactly that. Okay. And also, there is the, let's say, the security part in terms of guarding, but also the security part in terms of pure security, because on the boat, there is engines. Engines are running. If you have an issue with electricity at the deck you are, you might have to run your own electricity engines, which are diesel engines, and these needs to be checked. So basically, you have every time people. So at the port, when you're not on duty, you have a normal day. You do what you have to do. So basically, if you are from the administrative part, you will take care of what you have on board. So people who have requests, questions about salary, about going to formations, going to change assignments, stuff like that. If you are an electrician, you will be make sure you will maintain basically the electric network. If you are a navigator, you will update the maps, for example. You will take care also of all the navigation tools, making sure the boat, basically the main task, if we can put it in one sentence, is making sure the boat is ready to go anytime. That's how it is.
Actually, because we can do anything. It brings me to a question. So you're mentioning different types of works and jobs on the boat. To me, as a as a layman of military topics, when I think of a warship, I think, it's all soldiers on board. They all have their guns, and they're all cleaning their guns all the time, and some kind of military thing happening. How many people, roughly, out of those, again, roughly 100 people, are actual soldiers, and how many are electricians, engineers, officers, human resources, cooks, God knows what?
That's the funny part. We are basically, that's why when we earlier in the talk, I was speaking about specialization. It's important because everybody has a task on board, like you said, electricians. So basically, engineers, we have engineers on board. There are about 14 to take care of the engines. Administrative people, we are only two. For the human resources part. For the financial part, there are two as well. Officers, there were about 16. Navigator people, there were about 8 to 10. Cook, there is, if I remember correctly, 5 to 6 guys. And you have many other jobs on board. But all of us, and that's the, let's say, the funny part, is that all of us are able and capable of using weapons, as well as being firemen.
Is there no one whose only job is to fire guns? Or, to do the soldier and the warring part? Is everyone also a soldier and also something else?
We are all everything, more or less. That's for this kind of boat. Of course, there is bigger boats where you have this kind of frigate or something. And also, we go back to the specialization, as well as people are specialized, boats also specialized. The boat I was in is this kind of little, rapid, very rapid and fast boat. very easy to maneuver around. You have this frigate against submarines. You have this frigate and, against aerial attack. You have this special, let's say, hospital boat. There is a lot of different things. So each boat, and there is, of course, the aircraft carrier as well, the Charles de Gaulle.
Right. So we have one for those who don't know the French Navy has one aircraft carrier.
A beautiful one.
I don't know how many nations have aircraft carriers. I know the US has. I'm sorry?
Not much anymore.
Right.
China, Russia, America, if I'm not mistaken, Brazil.
Yeah, and I'm sure the U.S. has, like, I don't know, 50, one for every state or something. But
it's a lot, yes. Yeah. It's a lot. It's a very different one.
Okay, so let's get back to the daily routine. When you're, so you were saying at port, very boring. Let's switch to when you're at sea. What happens?
Many things. So the first thing is that the day is, let's say, defined by the condition. So what I mean by condition means what's the state we are in. Are we just in transit from Toulon to Corsica? So threat is pretty close to zero. Are we in search of immigrant boats trying to rescue these guys? Are we in the middle of Aden Gulf looking for pirates? This will change basically the level of threat and the, what we call condition of the boat. Depending on that, you will have what we call roles. And these roles will determine basically, I'm sure you guys have seen movies, even if they are very far from the reality, there is still a part of truth in it. Even in Star Trek, actually, I think the best example is Star Trek.
Okay.
If you look at the last TV show, Star Trek, they have this red alert, black alert, and basically people have different reaction depending on the color of the alert. It's exactly the same. Of course, we don't travel in universe, but I would like to, but no. Basically, if you have this combat mode, people know that at combat mode, they have a very specific position and something to do. If there is a fire alert, they know that they have something very specific to do. If there is a man over the board, they know that they have very something specific to do and a place to go. So taking my example, in case of fire alert, I was basically the part of the second team who had to go to fire. So basically we send the first team, and when they are out of oxygen or they are there for a certain amount of time, they come back. And I knew that I would be the next with a bunch of other guys. If there is a man at the sea, I know I would go to the deck and I would need to take care of the basically literally directing the boat, which doesn't mean I would decide where to go, but I would basically apply the direction of a guy that is a navigator, let's say master, so to speak. And at this kind of combat mode, I knew also what I had to do, which was part of the boarding team. Boarding team means we put this kind of big boat that was within our boat, basically. It's kind of Zodiac, so to speak, very big one. And we were about 12 guys going on there and basically boarding another ship.
So
it can be pirate ship or whatever, or suspected pirate ship.
That I would love to get into that. However much you can talk about it would be interesting.
Sure.
But so, you mean when you're the normal day, you start in the morning and it's basically like life at port, except you have all of these different statuses that you have to be ready for?
There is another twist.
Okay.
The day is split in what we call quarters. So basically, the day is split in slots of 4 hours. And every 4 hours, there is something else to perform, and a team take, let's say, the spot of somebody else. So basically, it's like inside duty. So you are on duty, but on the sea. Example, I need to go and use this, basically this direction post, where you basically apply the direction of the navigator. You know you have to do it from 8 to 12. This is part of basically the day. So you do it from 8 to 12, which means 12 to 16, you will be eating and doing something else, most probably your job, because your job doesn't stop you. So you're still part of the administrative team. So this is on the top of your job. Then 16 to 20, I will still be working most probably. 20 to 24, I will be eating and sleeping a bit. And then midnight to 4, you see, I did a full round. And I go back to basically this navigator thing. 4 to 8, wait. I would go to sleep. Yes.
So you sleep in 4-hour shifts, but not in 8-hour shifts? I would guess you have okay.
Yeah, exactly. So basically the night shift are 20 to midnight, midnight to 4, 4 to 8. So there's three different teams. But basically it's a constant roll. It's a ball that is constantly rolling. And it never ends. And it's like, it can be like that for a month, as soon as you're on the sea.
What's the longest you've stayed at sea without going back to port?
4 weeks and a half, if I remember correctly. 3 weeks and a half, maybe.
Okay, yeah. So about a month.
About a month, yeah.
Is that standard? Can
no, it's you long. Know? It's very long.
Oh, it's very long. Okay.
Yeah. It should basically, we try to be not more than 10 days to 2 weeks without seeing the ground, even for the boat itself, because we can't sustain each other's unlimitedly. We need fresh food, we need this kind of stuff.
Oh, right.
So yeah, it can happen that you basically reload on the sea, but it's a dangerous maneuver and we try to do it as less as possible.
Okay.
But yeah, it can happen, but it's really not standard. If there is one person in your audience that is actually from the submarine community, he will be laughing right now.
Okay.
Because submarine people and people who listen to us who are eventually having, who had experience in submarines, they can be months below the sea without seeing the sunlight.
Okay.
This is just crazy. But for boats, no, it's a bit, yeah. And also, it's not such a big boat. I mean, in a sense that it's only, so to speak, 90 people. It's very limited in terms of space as well. So you need for sure.
Sorry, you cut off for a second. It's only 90 people, sorry. But?
And the space is limited. So basically it means that you need to see and have fresh air at one point, because you basically, you are constantly with the same people 24/7. Even psychologically, you need to take fresh air at one point.
Do you get into, like, when you have the downtime, do you get like some gaming console going or some card games, and do you get into fights? Do you, is there social life, or is it just the constant grind of shifts? And
we try, but it's pretty hard, because basically, let's say the main social moment is the moment you eat, because you don't eat alone. You eat all together, not the whole boat, but basically we are separated into three corps, so to speak. You have the people who are from the soldier to what we call quartermaster, so just before petty officer. Then you have the petty officers who eat together, and then the officers who eat together. It's very separated, and it's very good, actually.
Which corps were you in?
I was a petty officer.
Okay.
The benefit of that is that by eating together, first it has this kind of course feeling of be part of something, but at the same time, let's say the young soldier just joined and doesn't like his boss. He has a moment during the day, during the food, where he's not with his boss, can just, you know, take the brain off and even say bad things about him. It's allowed. Yeah. And he knows that, you know, it's his moment. So we don't have much time for fun, so to speak. And the problem also is the room, because we don't have internet on board, or let's say extremely low speed.
Can you have your phone?
Not constantly. And you don't catch network anyway. So you're in the middle of the sea. There is no connection. And after you throw away two or three phones in the sea, you don't take it with you anymore.
Because
first iPhone ended up in the middle of the Indian Ocean, so it's still there.
All right. So yeah, so it's not like you're only in the Mediterranean. You go on pretty large routes.
Yeah. We can go the more far we went was almost Asia with this kind of boat. And it's not the biggest, more far.
Okay. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the operations part of it. You were saying you were rescuing migrants and
can be part, yeah.
searching for pirates and all of those. Is there anything that I'm sure there were things that you remember to this day, things that happened that gave you strong impressions, or things that you can talk about? Of course, I'm sure there are some things you can't mention, but what made the strongest impressions on you? If I were allowed, I would go like, were there movie-like moments where you would board a pirate ship and there was a firefight? And I want to say that, and then I realize, okay, this isn't a movie; it's real life. He actually might have gotten into a firefight, but you know, I'm still kind of asking without asking. And then you know, with migrants, I don't know things that you still remember.
Yes, of course there is. I mean, tension moment because. Especially, the migrant thing and the Aden Gulf and the piracy is a fully different thing. It's also important to remember the audience that the French Navy mission mostly is to basically detect and preserve people on the sea, which means that a lot of missions are here to basically keep people safe, but not the way we think it. Not like keep our borders safe, you know. It's more about what do you do when you see a migrant boat full of people with child, woman, and etc. And Army and French Navy and other navies as well, because Italian and Spanish navies are very much involved as well. The point is to protect both sides. Of course, we are here to protect our country, but not in an aggressive way, not in a nationalist way, so to speak. We are not here to push them back. We are here to make sure the sea and the oceans are a safe place to be for everybody. So that's for the migrant part.
So, okay. Let me call you out on this for just a second, because obviously the migrants crisis is a very sensitive topic, and politically it is something that is loaded, very loaded, and obviously the migrants in every country that is concerned by the crisis are have people who say we should welcome all of them, and some people who say well we can't welcome all of them. It's not, infinite, whatever, without getting into that part. How remote, how far away are you from that debate? And surely you've had instances where you had to, you saw a boat, you got the migrants maybe out of harm's way, but then you were like, sorry, but you have to go back to whatever country you came from, right?
We are not really, we are lucky. Actually, we are lucky because this is not our job. This is the job of the police. Our job is to basically make them safe. It's a bit of a coward move, so to speak. It's a bit easy, because we say, okay, we're fine. We did our job. So when, let's take the example, during the big migrant crisis, basically I was on the sea, still there on duty a few years back. And basically what happened is that if you see a migrant boat like that, it's absolutely illegal to let them there sink. So you have to save them. It's an obligation. So you do. So you welcome people on board. You give them food. You give them water. And then the question is, the decision is not on you and even not on the commander officer. The commander officer has to contact the relevant authorities. And the question is, what do we do with these people? Obviously, we won't throw them in the water. So we will bring them somewhere. And then from there, they will be taken. So we are not a judging authority. We are here to basically handle the complication in real life. But at the same time, we are still on orders. And these orders are strict and clear. So we can't sideways.
Right. Obviously, I mean, you're not going to put them on the boat and bring them back to France. No. I don't think anyone would expect that. So you kind of have the I don't want to say the easy job, but like the good part of the job. You rescue yes. the people from the sea, and then exactly. it's for the other people and politicians to decide what happens to them. But yeah. you're just here to make sure they're safe. What is your... And then here I'm talking about personal impressions mm-hmm. because... We hear about those stories and we hear about, you know, in the news, and it's all a little bit fuzzy and remote. What are your impressions of those events, you know, and those people and without turning into a soapy drama? Like,
no.
What did you think? Because you were there, you were witness to what happened there.
It's being very honest. It's horrible what's happening there. Without going into the politic thing of why they are there, we all know why they are there. One thing, and now that you are that, even Patrick, you can understand that even better now that I am as well. It's very simple. You take a 2-year-old child. Would you cross the Mediterranean Sea with your 2-year-old child without food and water? And go from Libya to France with your own will? So this is not possible. Nobody wishes that. Nobody wants that for his family. So people who say, again, it's personal, let's say, mix of experience and feeling and belief. But when I wish to people, I really do wish to people who are, let's say, saying what you were saying before as an example, like, yeah, we know we can't welcome everybody and, you know, we need to throw them back where they come from. I invite these people to go first, see where these people live and in what condition. And secondly, I invite them to do the same trip that they do on these rubber boats across the Mediterranean Sea. And let's see how do they think after that. Mm-hmm. And this is what I'm deeply thinking. You can't think that these people are doing that with an invasion, you know, mindset. It's impossible. These are just human beings who try to escape a place that is horrible. And even if where they go is maybe not the paradise, it will still be better than where they are. Mm. On the boat, we had immigrants. They were doctors, professors, you know, they just escape a war zone. My personal, let's say, feeling is that I was very proud and happy to be part of that because I did my tiny part, so to speak. But at the same time, I still find incredible that we don't solve that crisis. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that we can but don't want to. This is what I believe. Oh, we don't care enough. But we will be looked and judged as the generation who didn't do anything. Mm. I'm very sad about that, actually. But
when you say you think we can, you mean financially we could welcome them?
Of course. Let's be honest. Who would let a family of... there is an horrible thing, you know. I don't know if you remember a few, maybe month or maybe a year or something back. There's been a picture in the front of Time, the Time magazine, of a little boy dead on the beach, face on in the sand. And the whole world, Twitter, Facebook, everybody was extremely
outraged,
so to speak, shocked. Mm. Yeah, outraged and shocked. Because the reality finally reached the normal people. So people were like extremely shocked. And my question is, what did they do to change it? It made a big media noise, but that's it.
Yeah. I think the only thing you can do there, and I would, you know, there would be a lot that I could say about what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I think not necessarily only in, not just in support. I could argue mm-hmm. points. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to do that because here, as is very often the case in this show, we try to get, you know, we listen to the people who are actually in those situations. And I think what's valuable here is what you're saying. And you know what you're talking about because you were there. So I'm not going to add to that. But to answer your later point about the picture and what did people do, the only thing they can do is vote. And clearly, no one is... I mean, we're clearly expressing the fact that we don't care enough. And yeah, so that's just a factual.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's how it feels.
All right. Before we move on, I do want to get on to the pirate hunting thing, which I'm curious about. But to stay a little bit on that topic, how do you then, like, do you talk about it with your shipmates? Do you talk about it when you get home? How do you carry this with you silently? Like, how do you deal with it? How does it impact you after the fact?
I would say it's very personal. Everybody reacts differently. So I can talk for myself. Funnily, it felt like... And I think the uniform is made for that. You are a different person when you wear the uniform, as well as you are a different person when you are online behind, let's say, a character or something.
Yeah, in a game. Yeah.
Exactly. So it felt like, of course, it affects you. It affects you. Of course, it makes you a different person. But at the same time, I every time tried to not carry that with me at home because it's still work. Yeah. And you try to don't bring work at home, right? And at the same time, you kind of, when you put off the uniform, it's like the weight of the things also goes with your uniform away, you know, and you wash it and that's it. Mm. And you have to live with it. And this is also the power of the engagement in the army or navy or whatever is exactly that. That's what you commit to. It's not committing to war or to ultimate death or whatever. It's not that. The commitment you do is to be humble about what you do, the way you do it. And in one end, when you go home, you don't bring that back because you don't want to, you know? Mm. And it's also extremely hard to explain. It's extremely hard to explain. It's feelings, you know? Feelings to explain are extremely hard. So, as much as I could talk about it, nobody would really understand about it, what it is exactly. Mm. So you can say, you know, we got a migrant boat and we welcome them on board and we bring them to Italy and, you know, or to Spain or to Cyprus or whatever. And they are safe and you are happy because at least they are not on this boat anymore in the middle of the sea. They are still on the ground. Of course, there will be some justice thing and et cetera, but they are still safe. They won't die. They won't drown, literally. So, and that's more or less what you say, you know, and that's only it, more or less. Of course, it's a heavy thing to carry, but it's a funny one because you carry it with you in a sense that it's heavy because it makes you different and you think about it and it's not every time super cool. But at the same time, there is a feeling of being proud of being part of it, which kind of balance the thing, you know. Okay, it was horrible. It was very hard. I didn't sleep much. I didn't eat much. But at the same time, if I wouldn't be there, me and my mates, this guy would be dead. This child, this woman, and etc.
So actually, you did something about it.
Exactly. It was worth it. My lack of sleep, my everything was absolutely worth it.
A little bit of a meta question right now, like about your feeling towards what you're doing right now, like what you're telling us about your experience. Mm-hmm. You're saying you can explain it, but people will not really understand. Do you currently right now have the feeling that you're explaining it to me and through the show to the audience, but you know that, you know, maybe we're going to get a little bit of it and then we're going to go, you know, turn around and eat a sandwich and it will be forgotten? Or do you feel like you're not actually... I don't know, affecting us or transmitting, actually conveying what you would want to convey if you could in some other way? Or
yeah, the problem is that exactly that's the thing. Being in it and and doing it and saying about it is a different thing. And I think that my mission today would be complete if at least people would get interested, not in the army, but actually maybe to change their mind if they have a negative idea about it. Maybe to go get some information online. I'm not here to recruit new soldiers, obviously, not at all. But just to say that there is people actually, when you guys are sleeping, when you're celebrating Christmas, there is basically people around the world who are doing stuff. And this is something important to sometimes remember. Not the speech like, you are safe because of us. That's not true. Not only us, you're safe for many, many good reasons. But there is people who are pursuing their, let's say, dream of service, whatever the day, whatever the night. And to try to kind of pass, you know, there is one thing I cannot pass is the sense of duty. The sense of duty is a very personal thing. And that's why it can't be forced towards people. And that's why people who are forced to join the army usually don't stay long, because it's a personal choice. It's a very personal choice. As well as leaving, because I left as well. So it's a moment. You decide to go or not go, and to try. And that's why also I wouldn't like to be part of the PR in army, because, or the Ministry of Defense, because between what you can say and what you can explain and what you need to keep under the radar, it's extremely complicated, right? So you need to still make some advertisement because you need to recruit people. But at the same time, it needs to be well done, not too much warrior stuff. You need to explain things that you cannot really say. It's extremely complicated, actually, if you think about it. So, and it's okay. The same for us.
All right, let's move on to the to the pirate, like to the action. Let's cut to the chase. Let's go into the action scene and you know, imagine you and your teammates. Actually, I'm not going to make that joke. It's disrespectful. Let's talk about the pirate thing. Like, how did it's kind of the same you know, retelling of what happened with the migrants, the pirate thing. Where were you? What was happening? Are there events that stay with you even today? What could you say about this?
Well, I think the piracy thing is, let's say, not really secret, because it has been a big thing at one point. There has been some also news over the TV show and etc. about what's happening there. I'm not sure if it's still going on or if it's more calm, because we hear much less about it. Well, basically, the background story is very simple. There is a country named Somalia. Somalia is an extremely poor country. People can barely afford food, sadly. And to feed their family, they will basically voluntarily go on boats and try to steal from big ships. Big ships like these tankers, so to speak, where there is electronic and they try to get ransom out of it. So this is the piracy in Aden Gulf. It's nothing like Jack Sparrow. And basically the mission of army there is to keep the place safe for people to... Because the problem is that Aden Gulf, I don't know if people know where... More or less where it is, but basically the connection between the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea is made by the Suez Canal. Suez Canal starts basically north of Egypt and ends up in the south of Egypt. And then the next country you will cross are Yemen, Djibouti, Somalia, Eritrea, very beautiful places. So it became very unsafe. So commercially, it was very complicated for many, many companies to basically cross that spot. The only alternative they are is to go back in time and actually cross the whole Africa, all around, make the big round.
Right, so, to go south through the Cape.
So that's the place. So piracy was going on. If I may recommend a good movie to get very close to the reality, it's Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks, with very well made as a movie because it's in the shoes of the people who are boarded. The problem of most of the movies about piracy and etc., they are mostly made in the eyes of the soldiers, which is not good because it's very, let's say, war encouraging, so to speak. Captain Phillips is a very good movie because it also explains where these people come from, these pirates, what life they have and why they are fighting and what they are fighting for. Most of the pirates that you find there are starving. They don't have food. They barely have food and they drink the water of the sea. That's all they have. So it's a bit far from the reality in a sense, or what people think, that, you know, it's this kind of pirate boat, very powerful, with a lot of weapons and etc. Of course, there is weapons involved. These people try to defend themselves. But at the same time, we need to understand where they come from to have the right action towards these guys. So the mission of the Navy there is to protect basically the sea, as usual, to make sea a safe place. So the first phase goes into identifying. Then you basically decide whether or not you need to visit the boat, ask, of course, the authorization to do so, and then eventually react depending on what's the answer. And that's how far I can go.
Okay. So that means you're just patrolling. You have a route.
More or less, yes.
Yeah. And you see a boat that is maybe identified, maybe unidentified, and you're trying to judge whether or not this is a pirate ship or...
Yeah.
And then exactly. You decide whether or not you're going to board. And right, at that point, you can't really talk anymore because if you did board, then stuff happens.
Exactly.
Have you ever had to board a ship that had been boarded that by pirates or things like that? Yeah. Or does it? Okay.
No, these belong to other people.
Oh, okay. If that happens, then someone else is involved. Okay.
Yeah, there is. This will be the job of other people in army. Okay. If there is, let's say, there is a public story we can refer to is this Ponant story. So basically what happened is that a boat was crossing the Aden Gulf, a civilian boat, got attacked by pirates and special forces had to board. And then after they discovered that it was some drug as well on the boat. So it was a very grayish story. It was a bit weird. But that's basically the story.
Okay. So, okay, there are two things I take away from what you're saying is first, the job of the Navy, and I'm guessing the job of the, I mean, it's a shared job from different countries' navies that are, I'm guessing, engaged in the areas where their country's commercial interests are, need to be protected, in this case, the trade routes. And the job is to make those trade routes safe / usable.
Yes.
And the other part I'm noting is the pirates aren't let's find some booty. It's people who are coming from very poor countries trying to survive. And okay. All right. I think that's a significant amount of heavy information for one day. I do want to ask you about your interactions with the American Army, whatever you can, you know, the relationships there. Before we do that, is there anything else you would want to bring up, whether it is about your actual, you know, actions on the sea or the way the boat is organized or something I might not have asked about?
There is, I think all in all, the most important, if there is something to take out of our discussion, is to, since Army, at least in France, again, speaking for French people, is not extremely good at communication or the communication is not easy to do. I think for people just to not judge based on, let's say, very mainstream media. There is excellent blogs, Secret Défense blog, which is very great, for example, which is very official, nothing shady there. You can have information, and you know, as a veteran, I would say that when I was in Navy, I really loved when people came to me to ask questions, because since we are not allowed to talk much, when people come to ask a question, it feels great. Of course, I'm not saying you guys go and talk to the people patrolling under the Eiffel Tower. Don't do that. It's a very bad idea. But if you ever, you know, go somewhere and, you know, sometimes in France and even abroad, there is Navy warship who are stopping in your city. Just go and say hello and try to understand what these guys are made of and what's their life. And, you know, behind the uniform, and as you say, Patrick, you know, the version of the soldier we have in mind in the, let's say, the culture, behind that, there is dad, moms, normal people. Under the uniform, they're still human being. So don't be afraid to go talk to military people. They would be more than happy to answer your questions, and not only military-related questions. You know, just ask if the guy is doing well and, you know, how is life for him and et cetera, because, yeah, we are normal people.
I think in the US they would be, you know, they would embrace that kind of attitude a little bit more. Maybe buy a drink to the military person there, and you also mentioned, I think before we started recording, that your commander on the ship was a woman.
Yes,
I wonder how that. I mean, you said it now in different ships you do have a mixed crew, so both men and women. I'm not sure if you know exactly how well that's working, but if you can speak to that, and also to the, you know, to the woman commander, how did that work? I'm guessing pretty well. There were no incidents.
It worked. But. You know, well, the boat I was on was a man boat, exception made of officers. The reason is officers have rooms where they are alone. Which is not the case for others. We were per room, we were 24. So,
wow, okay.
Officers have a special status, it's like that. And so we can basically, and there is boats where there is women. I have even friends, women, who are serving on boats, who have been serving on boats, and that's absolutely fine. On my experience, it was fantastic because it felt good to have a different way of thinking towards our job. Not only our commander officer was a woman, but on the top of that, she was a young and talented officer. So she got to command the warship, and she was young for that. And talented as well, extremely smart. So, of course, there is natural respect due to the rank. This is not questionable because we're in army. But the experience working with a commander officer that is a woman was actually extremely rich for me. A way of thinking, a way of approaching the problems was absolutely different and better, actually. And in a manly world like this one, it's actually very, maybe it's linked to the mom thing, you know. I'm sure it's that, for men especially. I felt my mates on the boat more calm.
Funny. Really?
Yeah. Maybe it's linked to the mom thing or whatever. Yeah. I don't really know. I'm not a psychologist.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that she was an amazing officer, an amazing commander officer, an incredible human being, because she was extremely close to the people. Mm. She didn't have to, but she was. And I'm sure today, I don't know where she is now, but I'm sure today she's having great responsibilities, and I wish her, because she really deserves it. She was fantastic.
You're kind of making me want to serve under her now. It's kind of an incredibly glowing review. Somewhat related question. We do have social tensions in France, and we do have, second, third generation immigrants and who are in some, you know, the suburbs, the ghettos almost, from the big cities. Did you have any of those issues? I'm guessing, you know, men in close quarters, you would have people from all different parts of the country. Was that a factor, or did the military formatting do its job?
Yes, exactly. As you say, the military formatting does its job. Even more, you know, there is a funny thing in armies that normally you should be politically neutral, or at least not express your political impressions. You have the right to think, of course, and to discuss, but if possible, not publicly. And of course, you are not allowed to join a party. In terms of religion, it's a bit different, because how can you confront people to eventually death and take away the religion from them? You actually cannot. So what happened is that there is military priest, military rabbi, and military imam. So not only we were confronted to different, let's say, social backgrounds, but also we were confronted to different religions. I had mates who were Muslims, and they had the right to pray as much as the duty was not, let's say, impacted. The rule is the duty first, and then after that, if you want to pray, you're allowed to pray, and people should respect that. I even remember a guy, a stupid one, doing a bad joke about that, and some officer heard about it. Heard it actually live, and the guy got some sanctions. The guy did a bad joke about the religion and etc. And the guy had a sanction because it's not appropriate. We need to respect everybody here.
So you did have Muslims and Jews and Christians, obviously, interacting without incidents or significant incidents. It was just...
No problem. No problem at all. And even the food, you know, we had food for without ham, for example, for Muslim on the board. No problem with that.
Yeah.
Respect.
All right. To take us out of this episode, I do want to come back to the interaction with the Americans. How was it? Like, was there the Yankee feeling of the Americans, or were they super professional, or were like, was it army to army? We're like basically brothers in arms, and we know what we're talking about. How was the relationship? What did you think of the Americans, etc.? What did they think of you, if you know?
You know, the French magic, like I like to call it. So basically, when you're French and you're in a foreign country, or you're with foreigners, they have some sort of fantasy about Frenchies. That works in army as well, you know. So basically, when the interactions with Americans was actually great. Of course, it's another dimension. I mean, the budget is different, the people are different, the mindset are different, but not in a bad way. I mean, they just have a different politic in terms of army. So they are trained differently, and the chance to work or to see at least Rangers, Marines, and they are all great people. I mean, of course, they have a different mentality, and also, you know, the movies are also making us thinking in a way. You know, if you look at Full Metal Jacket and this kind of thing, you're afraid, you know, when you see a Marines, you're like, okay, the guy will yell at me, but actually, no, not at all. He's a normal person, you know, like you.
Right.
So they are all cool. They are very cool. Baby's coming.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a crisis there happening. Okay. He's not very happy, apparently, but it's okay. She took him to the kitchen and probably going to give food. Anyway.
No problem. Yeah. So yeah, Americans are very cool. They are doing their job. They have budget to do their job. They have budget to have proper gear and everything. But they was no, let's say, anger or anything towards people. It's mostly exchange, you know, because we have different protocols and everything. So usually it's more curiosity than nothing else. They come on board, you know, they ask, okay, you guys are using that, you know, we use that, and can you show us how it works? And, you know, I'm going to show you how mine work, and not only weapon, in general, navigation tools and et cetera. So the only thing that shocked me once I visited a very big aircraft carrier, American aircraft carrier, was that the commander officer was walking with bodyguards on board.
Oh, wow, really?
And that's a question actually to your American audience, if there is anybody, is why that? I mean, that was something, you know, you see the commander officer and hello. You see the, hello.
Well, we had our first participation of my son on a podcast.
I'm
yeah,
very
that's
proud.
The first one.
I'm so proud. So yeah, it's a bit different, but of course, I mean, we are having the same kind of sense of duty. You know, that's what I said earlier, that the sense of duty is basically the thing that brings us all together. And that's what we have in common. We can be from different religion, we can be from different backgrounds, different nationality even. We all serve a cause that we think right. So, and this is international. Even I had the chance to interact with Iraqi soldiers. And Iraqi soldiers, they were exactly like us. They have the same sense of duty, and they have their own, let's say, way of thinking and doing their stuff, because it's a different nationality and culture. But the sense of duty is the same. So we are all similar there, actually. We are all just one big world.
Well, that's a hopeful view. I hope it rubs off on me and the audience a little bit. So, thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing your story with all of us. I kind of already asked you, but anything else you want to add before we bring it to a close for good?
I think it's fine. I think it's fine. Yeah.
All right. Well, so again, let me thank you for being on. Do you want to tell the audience, do you have an online presence, Twitter account or something you want to direct them to? Or
AV user of Twitter. It's going to be hard for the foreigners because it's at Lebeg, so my family name, N, like Nicholas. So I think in the notes, it will be better. I think it was going to be noisy for them.
Yeah, we'll do that. I will include the Twitter link in the notes. So if you want to contact Nicolas, you know, ask questions or anything, you can do it, I'm sure, in the show's article in the comments, or go to Twitter, or I'm sure you'll find a way. So thank you very much for being on. For me, it's not Patrick on Twitter. You can also find me on Facebook. Same name, not Patrick. You can also find the show at frenchspin.com. And as I said, you can go there and comment on this episode if you have questions or want to comment on something that we discussed. You're very welcome to. And of course, as always, if you enjoy the show, if you think we bring a little something to your day, or we do something that you appreciate, please do consider subscribing to the Patreon and supporting the show on Patreon. That's at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. There's over 300 people participating in the Patreon right now. I'm incredibly grateful to all of them. And this show basically does not happen if the support isn't there. And I think the kind of business model basically that we have is very consistent with the spirit of the show. It's available no matter what, and the people who like it can choose to support it. And if you know, it's there's nothing forced, you can stop whenever you want. But if you think the show has some kind of value, please do consider giving value back. Even, you know, a couple of bucks per episode, even $1 is absolutely worth it. I mean, it helps quite a bit. So thank you very much for that. Again, the link is in the show notes. You can easily access it. That's going to be it for this episode. Again, thank you very much, Nicolas, for being on. It was super interesting. I hope I didn't batter you with questions too much.
No worries.
And we will be back probably towards the end of the month with a regular episode, unless, you know, the little mister behind me starts screaming too much and makes recording impossible. I think we'll be fine, though. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back very soon. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.